alternate genre. It was followed in 1858 by Eric or Little by Little by Frederick W. Farrar, which was even more muscularly Christian and even less fun. It tells the story of Eric Williams's gradual corruption by the vices and follies available to him once he's been sent off to school. It begins with a desire to keep in with his schoolmates, which prevents him from expressing a manly disapproval of the general cheating that goes on in his form, and soon he has gone totally to the dogs. There is drinking, in a pub. In vain do his pious best friend and brother expend their dying breaths exhorting him to change his ways and seek salvation. But alas, Eric attempts to escape his disgrace by running away to sea. He gets ill and comes home to die, repenting at last. And in case you were in any doubt about what you were supposed to take from it, Farrar's preface reads, "The story of Eric was written with but one single object, the vivid inculcation of inward purity and moral purpose by the history of a boy who, in spite of the inherent nobility of his disposition, falls into all folly and wickedness until he has learnt to seek help from above. I am deeply thankful to know, from public testimony and private, anonymous and acknowledged, that this object has, by God's blessing, been fulfilled. You will be deeply thankful to know that things relax somewhat thereafter." By the time Talbot Baynes Reid's Fifth Form at St. Dominic's was published in 1881, which is the most popular of the many school stories he published, it had become the thing we think of now when we think of school stories. Japes, mischief, comic and villainous staff, cosy studies, enduring friendships, sporting prowess, and bravely borne accidents and injuries playing out over a term. Meanwhile, back in real life, girls, middle-class ones at least, were starting to be publicly educated too. They were moving out from under governesses' skirts into day schools and, come the early 1900s, boarding schools too. The stories duly followed, beginning with L.T. Meade in the 1890s and on through the likes of May Baldwin, Dorothea Moore and Mrs. George de Horn Vasey, all of them pollinishly prolific, but all dogged by a rather confused public attitude to their work. On the one hand, people, which is to say reviewers and opinion makers, which is to say men, approved of their girls' school stories because the authors never deemed a heroine worthy of the name until she was fully conversant with the art of denial, self-sacrifice and other feminine necessities, the distaff equivalent of the noble, manly, empire-building skill advocated in the boys' books. But on the other hand, well, they were books written by women, about girls and about just girls. Girls supporting each other, being busy, happy, productive and competent, and altogether managing just fine without boys or men to make their lives meaningful. Their authority figures were female teachers and headmistresses, God and empire taking very much a backseat role, who would dispense comfort, wisdom and discipline in roughly equal proportions from their book and flower-filled studies, with occasional trips outside in inclement weather to rescue foolhardy charges blown over cliffs at midnight and catch lung infections, the better to bring home to them the consequences of thoughtless behaviour. Though we must in all fairness note that none of them beats the headmaster of Kipling's Storky & Co., who attends the sickbed of day pupil Stetson and sucks out through a tube the thick diphtheria mucus that is about to choke Stetson to death, knowing that he will probably contract the fatal disease himself as a result. If he doesn't, he will almost certainly die of a surfeit of honour instead. A world of happy, self-sufficient females was terrifically unsettling, what? Girls should be encouraged to read, but only the least challenging, least potentially corrupting stuff. Where did these school stories fall? Nobody knew. Because of this, and because it was so popular, and popularity is always suspect, because it was by and for women, because anyone could, and it sometimes seemed did, try their hand at it, the genre quickly became perceived as inferior, and as lesser writers copied tropes from abler ones, and made them both simpler and more commonplace, also became slightly moribund. Then, in 1906, like a wayward lacrosse ball into a swimming pool, Angela Brazel's The Fortunes of Philippa landed with a splash in the stagnant genre and started its revival. She wrote firmly from the schoolgirl's point of view, happily incorporating their slang wholly on their side. She was swiftly followed by Elsie J. Oxenham with Rosalie's New School in 1913, and in 1920 by Dorita Fairley Bruce with The Senior Prefect, later renamed Dimsey Goes to School. Fairley Bruce was the first to write a series of school books about the same characters, Dimsey, the lively new girl with a spirit as irrepressible as her fine head of brown curls, and her friends Erica, stern, Rosamond, soft, Jean, poet, and Pam, sporty, and I found them all waiting for me on the shelves of Torridon Library. I had loved already Enid Blyton's Mallory Towers and St. Clair's series, but the Dimsey books were an even more detailed and intriguing window onto a bygone scholastic and social era, when a sunny day meant teachers could spontaneously decide on a nature ramble without consulting the national curriculum. Something called the honour of the school could be at stake, and adolescents could be free of sex and full of sorority. They were a great solace to me. At 10, school, sex and sorority were giving me no end of trouble. As we all entered double figures, the split that had started 3 or 4 years earlier was complete. Where once boys and girls had played together happily, now they didn't. The girls had hived themselves off and stopped running around and getting sweaty. They played with each other's hair and compared frilly ankle socks and fancy pencil cases instead. If a boy spoke to you now, you had to giggle instead of answer. Boys were baffled. I was baffled. I tried giggling once, but it was not to be. And now no one was allowed to read. If you were a girl, it was because it was unfeminine and left you less time for comparing sock notes. And if you were a boy, it was because it was unmanly and left you less time for football. I felt that this was at the very least illogical, but I couldn't find anyone who cared, much less agreed with me, when I tried to point it out. I withdrew from the fray. Literally, I could read, undisturbed, I discovered, in the outside loos. Cold in winter, smelly in summer, no one ever went as far as the last cubicle in the row or lingered in the outhouse longer than they had to. If I'd had the wit, I'd have taken a few cushions down there and decorated the place like Dimsey and her pals did their sixth form studies and later books, or added some wine and candles and called it a salon. A shitterary salon. Could have been nice. For Dimsey, by contrast, all was broad, sunny uplands of both the real and metaphorical kind at the Jane Willard Foundation. Reading and learning of all sorts were encouraged. So were sports, but I was willing to overlook that. I couldn't work out if it was because they were free of boys, modernity, or both, but the girls seemed to be able to be themselves. Yes, impractical daydreamer Jean, poet, remember, was frequently told to buck up. But that was fair enough. She did keep accidentally starting fires in potting sheds, after all. And Dimsey did form the Anti-Soppist League to curb Rosamond's penchant for crushing on unsuitable seniors, but this only gladdened my heart. Anti-Soppism was exactly the movement I needed. It stood for everything I couldn't put into words. It was anti-convention, it was anti-self-indulgence, it was, above all, anti-mindless femininity. It gave those of us who couldn't master the conventions a means of rejecting them and another banner to gather under. I say us, I mean me. I wouldn't find another 5 like-minded souls in real life until I went to university, but thanks to Fairly Bruce and her creations, I didn't really need them. Of course, though I and innumerable other readers who, through the vagaries of time, class, space and fortune, had not managed to go to the Mallory Willard St. Winifred's Chalet Foundation, took these tales as virtual reportage, the schools, these enclaves of spirited yet honourable girls and dedicated teachers, were always idealisations. If reading were purely about providing us with accurate renderings of social history, this would be a problem. But of course it's not, and it wasn't. However buffed and polished the setting, and the selection of characters, the deeper truths remained. Theirs was a world that pointed towards a different way of organising things, a different set of priorities, some of them deliciously intangible. It wasn't until I'd read my way several times through the series that this nebulous concept of honour, for instance, be it individual or of the school, began to resolve into some kind of comprehensible shape, and beyond that, to the idea that nothing is immutable. Ars longa, even when shaped by genre constraints, vita remains remarkably brevis. It wasn't until many years later, when I actually was at university, in fact, haunting the haunted bookshop in St. Edward's Passage in Cambridge, and gradually piecing together a collection of Dimsey editions from the 1920s and 30s, of which the owner always kept a plentiful stock, that I realised that the colourful hardbacks in the library had been modernised editions. They had still seemed wonderfully old-fashioned to me, but the real things had a much more distinctive tang. However carefully you update a book, and especially one from a genre like the girls' school story, which is so redolent of a particular time and place, you're interpolating something between the reader and the writing and creating detachment. When you read original Dimsey's, or Brazzell's, or Oxenham's, whatever their flaws, they speak untrammelled early 20th century to you. They speak without irony, without muddied waters, without self-consciousness, without fear of parody. They feel as young, bold and innocent as their heroines themselves. A different time, living on between buckram covers for as long as there are people willing to open them. Just how long that will be, I don't know. Their popularity began to lessen in the late 1950s as private boarding schools and day schools became, with the advent of free secondary education after the Second World War, a thing of the past. Now, the better part of a century on from when most of them first appeared, they are ancient relics. To come across them at all at the right age requires the tomes either to have been passed down through at least 4 generations of readers and still to be lingering on accessible family bookshelves awaiting discovery, or for a 10-year-old to have a particularly early affinity with second-hand bookshops and the wherewithal to fund what can now be a fairly expensive habit. In my day, Eleanor Brent Dyer's Shalley School books recounting the adventures of Joey Bettany, Mary Lou Trelawney and Len Maynard at school in Austria, Guernsey, the Welsh Borders or Switzerland were still on sale in shops, and they were still a potent enough cultural presence to make plays such as Daisy Pulls It Off a success. Now they and the world they dwelled in, and which dwelled in them, have slipped beyond the immediate reach of folk memory, and I suspect there is little chance of their popularity returning. There are clay tablets dating from around 2000 BC recounting anecdotes set in schools for the entertainment of ancient Sumerian child readers, and similar texts, the Colloquia Scholastica, were common in medieval England, and included all the banter, bullying, laziness and cheeking of teachers that has apparently been the mainstay of the educational experience since it began. There have always been and always will be plenty of stories set in school, for at least as long as children go to school. But they are not the school stories of yore. Yore's gone, and with it its stories. Rosamond would no doubt weep. The rest of us must just stop being so madly maudlin and simply buck up. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let us return to my new hopes for my new school. I reckon that the fact that it would be all girls, plus the maturity we would all gain over the summer, we would be 11 by the time we started the term. 11! I wondered if I should start saving for a pension. Meant that I was almost certain to find myself in Catford's answer to the Jane Willard or, at a pinch, St. Clair's. The details would be different. Skirts instead of tunics, tarmacked playground instead of lacrosse pitches, bus down the high street every day instead of termly drop-offs from a steam train. But beneath that, same. Thus it was that I discovered that, as well as expanding your mind, your consciousness, your empathetic facilities, your vocabulary, your sense of awe and wonder at the multitudinous possibilities offered by the world, books could also lie through their teeth. Chapter 9. Darkness Rising. Secondary school and, not unrelatedly, dystopia. Oh, look, it wasn't too bad. So people wouldn't leave you alone to read and hated you if you tried. So there were no outdoor loos to escape to. So life became an even greater welter of unspoken and fast-changing rules about everything from acceptable skirt length, labia skimming, and first bra, tammy girl, padded, to school bags, Chelsea girl only, or you might as well not even bother, yeah? To bands, I don't know, I got lost after Bros. To smoking, consulate upstairs in McDonald's like a lady, not Burger King. These things are sent to try us. At least secondary school had a better library. A full classroom of wooden shelves all round the walls and extra ones sticking out into the room. It was proper. It even had a few little carrels here and there, high-sided nooks where you could read or work almost unseen. Sit there and it was like having your own personal section of a Womble Burrow. I needed the security for 2 reasons. First, because I had just discovered dystopian fiction. This was new to me and fairly new to the world of children's books as a whole. Although the world of fables and fairy tales and the golden age of railway children and secret gardens had been smashed to pieces by the cosh of 2 world wars, the growing realism of children's fiction that replaced it took a while to shake off fully the impulse to protect young readers and embrace presenting them with possible worse fates instead. You need time to recover from real-life catastrophes before you can bear to face and posit new ones to come. Authors like John Christopher, maybe more safely distanced by the double remove of writing not just fiction but science fiction, got there first, in the late 1960s, with books such as his Tripods trilogy, later Quartet, wherein the human race is enslaved by their cappings by an alien race, to be followed by the likes of Peter Dickinson's The Changes series, Science Fiction Without the Science, he called his story of the human race turning against machinery and regressing to a feudal state. My introduction to the genre was through the 2 that perhaps best symbolised and distilled the nuclear anxiety of the 1970s and 80s. Robert Swindle's Brother in the Land and Robert C. O'Brien's Zed for Zachariah, 2 tales of post-nuclear war survival so harrowing that I couldn't keep them in the house. Lucy Donovan's cousin Sophie had lent me the former, and I kept having to return it to her and re-borrow it the next day so that I could read and try and process once more the unsparing story of Danny and his attempts to look after his younger brother Ben, as their fellow survivors become increasingly desperate and those in charge steadily more tyrannical. Anyone disabled, injured or shocked beyond help, spacers they're called, is poisoned or shot. A concentration camp is established, prompting the formation of a rebel movement that for a brief and shining moment until it becomes clear that the irradiated barren land will make it impossible for anyone to survive for long, seems set to carry the day. The story's careful detail, the hair falling out in clumps, the trillions of deadly radioactive particles settling like an invisible snow on the devastated earth, and psychological truth, the survivors grow ruthless by degrees as resources and hope diminish, made it compelling and almost unbearable at the same time. Forced to confront unspeakable horrors and follow them through with Danny to the quietly shattering end, I closed the covers each time with a sigh of relief and some disbelief that I had survived. Z for Zachariah belonged to the school library, and I read it there when I could, and then put it firmly back on the shelf until the next time. Back then, I found the story of Anne, a lone survivor on a remote farm, and her relationship with the radiation-poisoned man, John Loomis, whom she nurses back to some kind of health after he stumbles across her home a year after the war, slightly less traumatic than Brother in the Land. At least once I got over the shock that the same mind who had given me lovely Mrs. Frisbee was also capable of creating this. But now, when I read it, the multiple threats posed by the controlling and manipulative Loomis strike me the hardest. He's emblematic in a way I didn't appreciate then, of a kind of man who is, if anything, more threatening, through the sheer weight of his numbers, before an apocalypse than after, when there are only a few lives left to ruin. By the end of those two, I felt I'd come a very long way from Millie Molly Mandy. Rereading them now still harrows my inner 12-year-old, but it gives the rest of me a twisted hankering after a simpler time. From this distance, O tempora, O mores, O Brexit, O Trump, we seem to have had it easy. One major worry, one simple solution, read the cautionary tales and don't set off the bomb. Job done. All in all, it's a mad, 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 mad world out there. Perhaps the best and only real remedy, then, is to grab a good book come survival manual, hunker down and pray for daylight. Meet me in the bunker, but if you come with Brother in the Land, please, please keep it to yourself. Just as I was getting to grips with these page-bound horrors, real life dropped something of a bomb on us all, too. My dad, very quietly, went and got cancer. The world was quite dystopian altogether. He had been, very quietly, under the weather for ages. He had what seemed like flu for so long that it eventually became obvious that it wasn't flu at all, and the GP started sending him for tests. My parents tried to keep it from us, but they were relatively unpracticed in the secretive arts, and we knew something was up. At one point, when doctors were still cycling through possible diagnoses, we overheard my mother on the phone to Grandma saying something about Legionnaire's disease. In a moment that demonstrates as neatly as any moment ever could the fundamental difference between my sister and Mud Turtle me, my sister headed straight for the dictionary to work it out, and I waited to be told. Unfortunately, it didn't have the actual phrase, so her research only ended in further confusion. We understood that having little members of the French Foreign Legion walking about inside you would make you feel unwell, but not how they would get there. I thought maybe he caught it when we watched the TV series Beau Geste a few years earlier, and the soldiers had lain dormant in his blood before, I don't know, going to war over his lymph glands? We'd heard that phrase being whispered too. No, the whole thing was implausible. We knew we must have missed a step somewhere along the way. So, it turned out, had the doctors. While they retraced their paths, Dad sat, quietly, on the sofa, getting thinner and quieter. Mum got busier and noisier. Grandma came down more often and played more Bobby Shafto for us. Eventually, the doctors found what they had missed, and it turned out to be Hodgkin's disease, or cancer of, ta-da, the lymph glands. You're very lucky, said his doctor, still flushed with the thrill of discovery. It's a young man's disease, but if you got it then, you'd be dead. Things are much better now. And they were, in the very important sense that Dad didn't die. But it was a grueling year of treatment for him and for my mother, as he sat on the sofa getting thinner still, and quieter, and colder. We used to heap more and more blankets on him as each cycle of treatment progressed, and then peel them off as each one ended, and balder and bluer, as the dye telling all the scanner and radiation whatnots where to go, worked its way through his system. My sister used to sit behind him and stroke what remained of what she called his rabbit hair. I want to say that I retreated into my books, but I'm not sure that's true. Partly because I was already reading as much as was humanly possible. I couldn't have retreated further into my books without coming out the back and meeting myself around the front again. And partly because, again, my sister and I were protected from the worst of it. We never really knew that he might die, and, not really having any understanding of what chemotherapy felt like, that was all that mattered to us. except for one awful evening when he started to cry, and Emily and I, thinking he was pretending, started to laugh. Over the supper we were all eating on our knees, his heavily blanketed, in front of the television. We thought that everything was basically okay. But I think perhaps my books did become more important to me than they might otherwise have done. Maybe I wasn't retreating in the sense of reading more, but perhaps I escaped more fully into them now that there was something to escape from. At a more practical level, his illness threw me back on already accumulated resources. I reread more, and books I hadn't quite fancied when Dad had first brought them home took on a new attractiveness now that my main supply had been cut off at source. One day, up in my room, the rules about reading only in communal areas having been temporarily suspended, I reluctantly picked up a paperback that seemed to have been hanging around for ages. It looked awful. Its cover was so drab, even for me, a child with an abnormally high drab tolerance, that it almost made me cross. The whole thing was in tones of brown, a picture of a wood-panelled corridor and a big wooden notice board, relieved only by the dark, almost brownish-blonde hair of the twin girls standing in front of it, and the dark blue of their tunics. One had her hands covering her face in sorrow, and the other was gingerly trying to comfort her. The setup was not inviting. Also, it was a school story, End of Term by Antonia Forrest. At 12, I felt a bit too sophisticated now for school stories, a bit played out in the whole jolly hockey sticks field, you know? But needs must. And so I lay on my bed and opened those uninviting covers. By the time I closed them, several hours later, a towering, passionate and enduring love had been born in me, for the Marlowe twins, their friends, and above all, for their creator, who had given me a new world to live in and a new level of writing and reading to get to grips with. Richard Adams said of Watership Down that he had set out to write a grown-up book for children. Forrest did not set out with any such conscious intention. In fact, her first book about the Marlowe family, Autumn Term, was conceived as simply the most likely way to get a publishing contract at the time, 1948. But nevertheless, that is exactly what she did too. End of Term and Autumn Term, The Cricket Term and Attic Term, which I would discover in due course, are technically school stories. They are set at Kingscote Boarding School, and the events the twins, Laurie and Nicola, and their sisters take part in there include many of the standards, being unfairly left out of teams, getting and not getting parts in the school play, negotiating friendships, shifting loyalties and small treacheries. But there are no high dramas, no gorse-anchored clifftop rescues, no hidden heirlooms, no near drownings, no mysterious figures who turn out to be long-lost uncles or overzealous guardians. Boarding school story conventions are in fact often lightly mocked. At one point, for example, Tim, real name Thalia, a muse or something, mother would have it, though father did his best, likens Nicola to a character being very, very competent and awfully, awfully keen. Kingscote is not an idyll. Its pupils are not perfect, and neither, more shockingly, are its teachers, whom the pupils see at all times with clear rather than ennobling or idolising eyes. Rowan, one of Laurie and Nicola's older sisters, describes her relationship with headmistress Miss Keith as delicately balanced on a razor edge of mutual toleration, a wonderful phrase that I took instantly to my heart and have used many times in life since, and it encapsulated what I was most drawn to about the characters and the writer. The cool command they shared, the slight sense of detachment from life in order to keep perspective on it. It was like a bracing plunge bath after the close, sweaty sauna of more traditional school stories. You emerge from a Forrest novel, and I instinctively reach for that word rather than book or story, because everything in it was as finely and accurately drawn as in any fiction for adults, as braced as you had been entertained. My mind felt keener and sharper after every reading. Maybe it even was. Forrest's characters, especially Nicola, who is at the heart of all but one of the Marlowe books, grew and developed in the course of the book and the series in a way I'd not come across before. Everything about them was so precisely drawn that it made me whimper with pleasure. At the beginning of End of Term, for instance, Nicola befriends through force of circumstance a new girl, Esther. They get on well enough, but they don't really have much in common. By the end of the book, Nicola regards her new acquaintance thus. She still thought Esther awfully pretty. Beautiful, she amended shyly. But she wouldn't really mind if she ended up in another form. The first time I read that, I genuinely wriggled with delight. That the forthright, rigorously honest Nicola would amend her thought is perfectly judged. That her undemonstrative nature would also cause her to amend it, even within the confines of her own mind, shyly, ensured that the readerly cup of satisfaction runneth over. and the overlapping layers of consciousness involved in moments like Patrick's interest in Nicola's tale of woe at being lied about by the treacherous older girl Lois Sanger, again, not drawn as a simple villain, but a messy tranche of human flaws and weaknesses, none decisively contemptible in themselves, but together amounting to something much worse than the sum of their parts. How queer, he says. I wonder how she thinks about it. Well, what does she tell herself? I mean, how does she make it all right for herself? Or doesn't she? Does she think she's a heel too? Which in turn makes Nicola a bit cross. She would rather have a bit of sympathy, she decided, than all this speculation about Lois Sanger. But Patrick has been out of school too long, and is maybe simply too much of a boy to quite understand. As a portrait of how we interpret ourselves to each other to each other, and how little ever goes unmediated in life, it is quite brilliant. Patrick, incidentally, was also Catholic, like the author, who'd converted from Judaism at a young age. The first I'd met in a book, and it pleased me very much. He displaced Dickens in my pantheon of childhood literary crushes. I recognised his various struggles with his conscience in me, and his stubbornness and frustration with his faith in the members of my wider family, and he felt immediately, deeply, like a friend. Again, it made me wonder, as Private Keep Out made me wonder, if that tiny thing meant so much to me, how much more does seeing yourself mean when you diverge more fully from the expected narrative? The hits just kept on coming in end of term. There was the moment the singing director for the school Christmas service, Dr. Herrick, coaches Nicola in the singing of her opening solo. Try to sing it with regret, he urges. Once in Royal David's City. Not now, you see. Now we have only been pretending. But once, long ago, if we'd only had the luck to be there, just once this thing really happened. Have you ever come across anything that better captures the evanescent magic of a carol service? A better evocation of the mass of love and memories, past and present, yearning, joy and sadness all knotted up together, that for most of us comprises Christmas. Under Forrest's and Dr. Herrick's tutelage, I could hear the deep music in a glorious song of old. And then, I could go on forever about this single book of Forrest, but I will limit myself to just one more scene. There was the truly revelatory moment that came after Laurie, who has recently lost out on the coveted part of shepherd boy in the school play to Nicola, crawls into bed with a secretly injured leg, another standard trope which again in Forrest's hands becomes so much more than a simple plot device, to consider whether she should suggest that Nicola, who has similarly been left out of the netball team for unknown reasons, pretend to be her and play in the match instead. She runs through the different possibilities. First, the easy one. What fun it would be for Nicola to play and how nice of Laurie to let her. Second, less disinterested, that if she does let her, someone will somehow arrange things so that she can have a crack at playing shepherd boy. And finally, the underneath part, the bit she didn't like, thinks that if Nicola does play netball and gets found out, she'll be chucked out of the play, and then even though Laurie won't be playing shepherd boy either, she won't feel so bad about it. It was the most comprehensive, delicate anatomizing of someone's inner life I had yet met, and I raced on. As the Marlowe series progresses, Nicola, her friends and her siblings discover that life in and outside school is hard to negotiate, full of compromises and moral equivocations, and that the adult world is no promised land. Forrest provides agonizingly exact portraits of the psychological bullying in which girls, then, now and forever, specialize, and there is a quiet, heart-stopping moment in end of term when Nicola realizes that the friend they made in the first book, autumn term, Tim, is no longer her friend as she is Laurie's. She sat very still. Even her legs stopped swinging. Because it was nearly always like that, she took it for granted that people liked her better than Laurie. Only Tim didn't. Tim liked Laurie best. I could feel that simple, bald final line dropping like a cold pebble into my soul, as it must have Nicola's. In cricket term, death intrudes, followed by a subtle yet brutally realistic and unsentimental scene in which the girls try to navigate not just their first experience of death, but the death of someone they didn't like very much. The school set books are interspersed with others about the Marlowes at home in the holidays. They weren't available to buy by the time I was looking, urgently, for them, but still hanging on just in libraries. I eventually tracked down Falconer's Lure, a pony book in which the pony is replaced by a falcon. The Marlowes and the Traitor and Runaway Home, adventure stories, all of whose traditional ingredients and constraints are as transformed and transcended by Forrest as the school stories are in the others. And there was Peter's Room, whose story of the Marlowes imitating the Brontes' angrier and gondol-weaving antics I worshipped beyond all the others, until I discovered what I think is Forrest's masterpiece, The Ready-Made Family. Karen, the oldest sister, returns from Oxford with the news that she is marrying Edwin, an older, widowed, well-separated Don who already has two children. After the wedding, they all come and stay at the Marlowe family pile, Trenholds. The rest of the book has a perfunctory plot, while the meat of it explores the tensions created by the sudden advent of Edwin, a difficult man to like at the best of times, and his children, and their rarely articulated burden of sorrow, into the family's life. In the final chapters, one of the children, Rose, runs away. Nicola realizes she's probably gone back to her mother's house in Oxford, and rescues her from the near clutches of a man who's pretending to be her uncle. A lesser writer would make the return of Rose to her new family and a new start the happy ending of the book. Instead, Forrest lingers on Rose's train ride back to Trenholds with her father and Nicola, and delivers a delicate, almost unbearably moving portrait of and meditation on grief. Edwin asks Rosie why she ran off, and she says she just wanted to go home. "But you knew there'd be no one there." "I thought perhaps..." There was a long pause. Then Rose turned her face against Edwin's coat and said, "I do miss Mummy so." Almost absently, Edwin put his arm around her. Presently, in a voice as low as her own, he said, "So do I, Rosie. So do I." There are times, as Nicola discovered at that moment, when it is more tactful to stay put than go discreetly away. Nicola clenches her fists, trying to prevent floods of tears. For Rose, for Edwin, most of all perhaps for Karen. At the time, she could have found no words to describe this engulfing melancholy. But a year later, when her friend Miranda was called on during a Latin lesson to translate the time-smooth phrase sunt lacrimae rerum, which she did doubtfully as, "There are tears of things," only to be asked by Miss Cartwright what that was supposed to mean, Nicola, though she could have offered no better translation, thought of that train journey and knew exactly what it meant. Nothing is simple in Forrest's world, because people are not simple, and she is an elegant but uncompromising realist. Hers are complicated books, but among the most fulfilling I ever read as a child, and remain so for me today. Rose's ageless grief, known to Virgil and before recorded time, is captured forever in her pages. The Marlowe books, and Forrest's one non-Marlowe volume, The Thursday Kidnapping, are an intimation of the deeper joys than narrative excitement that fiction can yield. It is for the psychological acuity and the beauty and clarity with which it is expressed that we read. It was all of this that prompted the author Victor Watson, who has written widely about children's literature, to describe Forrest as Jane Austen for the young. But unlike Austen, Forrest has never received her due. She fell out of fashion. She was thought to be too dense, too complex, and just too full of Latin tags for the hip young things of the 1970s onwards, and spent a long time out of print. In the 1980s, only the school stories were reprinted, and seemed weirdly disjointed without the intervening books to explain references to earlier adventures, and the appearances and disappearances of multiple characters. Forrest would probably never have been an author with a mass audience, but this dicking about with the books must surely have contributed to her work's relative anonymity throughout her life. It's an inequity that made me rage violently when I first discovered it, but the edge of my tide of fury was turned when a tiny independent publisher called Girls Gone By started republishing them all a few years ago. Antonia Forrest fans remain a small group compared with those of Eleanor Brent Dyer and others, but we are mighty and evangelical. We will, together, spread the word and hopefully ensure a flourishing Forrest for years to come. Consider this a couple of acres worth and a tiny dent in the debt I owe her. The library. I also had a lot to get through elsewhere. The school library turned out to be pretty fertile ground. As well as harrowing dystopias, it also had old favourites like Tom Sawyer in the classics section, new meaty stuff like Alan Sillitoe's The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, and lighter fare like Sugar Mouse, the story of a girl coming to terms with her diabetes, and glory of glories, The Lily Pickle Band Book. I looked up at the top of the cabinet one day, where a few hardbacks were standing on display, and there it was, cartoonish figures on a white background, shining down at me while a celestial choir started singing in the background. Another book by my beloved Gwen Grant. I reached up reverently and took it in my humble hand. It was true. She had written another book for me. Not about the same girl, but as near as damn it. The heroine, Lily Pickle, is a reincarnation of the nameless heroine of Private Keep Out. She still lives in a Nottinghamshire mining town, but this time, contemporaneously-ish. The book was written in 1982. There are council estates and a certain amount of lightly sketched deprivation, but no hint of the Iron Lady and the trouble she was about to cause. And still as gobby, world-weary, and altogether magnificent as her ancestor. Lily's dad left when she was six, but is reckoned no great loss to the family, as he wanted to name her Honolulu Baby, after this lass wearing nothing but a blade of grass and a smile he once saw in a film. Like Private, the book is basically her diary, this time about the putting together of a neighbourhood children's band by indefatigable local troopers Mr. Kendall and Mrs. Warren. This band, though, is different from any other band I've ever heard about, because you don't have to know how to play anything at all to be in it. All you have to do to join is nod. Lily, Mavis Jarvis, about 12 feet tall, 12 feet wide and 100 feet thick in the head. He could spit rivets at her head and she wouldn't even notice them going in. And assorted other juvenile flotsam and jetsam from the surrounding flats nod. And various chaotic escapades ensue. It wasn't quite as good, nothing will ever be quite as good, as the Private trilogy, but it was still a joy, and all the more so for being so wholly unexpected. In lessons, alas, we were still murdering books aloud, this time on a grander scale. Lord of the Flies, 1984, Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, out loud, in their entireties, page by seemingly infinite page at a time. On the upside, by the time we finished, the first year of school was over and my dad was better. Weak, thin, still bald, and looking almost as battered as our copies of Wuthering Heights, but cancer-free, as he has remained ever since. So hurrah, may I say, and, while I've got an audience, a big thank you to modern Western medicine, to that. Chapter 10. A Coming of Age. I had also, by the end of that first year, hold on to your hats here, made a friend. No, a real-life friend, made out of flesh and blood and everything. Although, not much flesh, now I think about it. Sally was, and is, a gangling wreck of a human being. She was tall, thin, had giant goggly eyes and a tiny face, and was mostly out to enjoy herself. This usually took the form of pulling faces and periodically making a reverberating "urgh" noise, which could express joy, disappointment or interest as the mood took her, but was usually done just to unsettle people. I can neither reproduce it fully myself nor do full justice to its jarring effects as it emanated from her fragile frame. She was kind, she was funny, she was 10 types of idiot, and I insisted that she became my friend. I called her Pinhead because of her tiny head, which was responsible for her tiny face. I don't know what was responsible for the eyes. And she called me Bubblehead because, she pointed out, my skull was not round like normal people's but had a big lump at the back that made it look like it was blowing a bubble. We commended each other's honesty and accuracy and were inseparable from then on. She also, it emerged, liked books. Not quite as much as she liked people. This was at first baffling, but would become increasingly useful over the years. But she read them, lots of them, and she liked them. Our tastes overlapped rather than matched. Sally was a romantic rather than sensible person like me. She liked poetry, which only ever made me go hot with embarrassment at all the naked emotion on display. This is why there will be almost no talk of poetry in this book. I can't bear it and never could. All that feeling, all that true, fully accessed, held up to the light, turned slowly round and examined in all its microscopic, exquisite, agonizing detail, owned, digested feeling, felt by the writer, then rendered slowly, painfully into the handful of elusive words, the clutch of evocative sentences that will convey it in its purest form to the reader, who will then embark on the same process in reverse. Madness. Who wants to put themselves through that? Sally even liked Jane Eyre and the roiling lunacy that was Wuthering Heights. But we both loved Jill Peyton Walsh's Fireweed. It was a love story sufficiently full of feeling to engage Sally, but short and sparing enough with its emotions not to embarrass me. The tale of Bill, an unhappy evacuee during the Second World War, who returns to London to fend for himself until his soldier father comes home, and Julie, a fellow fugitive, whom he meets while sheltering in a tube station during an air raid, was the first time since Goodnight Mr. Tom that a book had caught me off guard. As the Blitz shatters London around them, Bill's feelings for Julie deepen and flourish like the fireweed that takes root in the bomb sites all over the city. When Julie is eventually injured and hospitalised, her parents find her, and the intrusion of adults and their all-consuming concerns about class and propriety destroy Bill's fragile idyll. They whisk her back home, and Bill is left to wander the ruins of London alone, watching the plant take hold everywhere. "They will build on this again someday," he says in the final lines, "but I like it best like this, grown over, healed." We both clutched our adolescent chests, me metaphorically, Sally literally, as our hearts swelled and threatened to burst with the repressed passion and nobility of it all. It was glorious. all the more so for the feeling being shared. Maybe this was what those puffin posters had been enjoying all those years. I was quietly devastated to discover a few years ago that the author is no longer terribly enamoured of her book. I went to a lecture about Philippa Pierce, and at a gathering afterwards someone pointed out Jill Peyton Walsh to me. I'd had just enough white wine to give me the courage to tell her how much I'd loved Fireweed. She listened gravely to whatever idiotic fragments of introduction and explanation made it out of my mouth, and then proceeded to tell me briskly, I remembered then that she had been a teacher before turning to writing for a living, that she did not like Fireweed at all anymore, that the parents' intervention was crass, they seemed to come from another book, and that although she had considered it all right at the time, she now looked on it more or less as juvenilia. Suitably chastened, I slunk away. But now, at a safe chronological and geographical distance, I find that my marginally mutinous teenage self is stirring, and I wish to say, so what? A book belongs as much to the reader as to the author. I have reread it recently, and although I can see what she means now about the parents' intervention, it didn't matter to me then, and I'm sure that it won't matter to any young reader who takes it down from the shelf at any point during that happy time when romantic longings are still outpacing critical faculties, and that they will find it as illuminating, moving, and satisfying as I did. I hope they have a Sally to share it with, too. That really is a good feeling. As a final flourish at the end of that triumphant year, I won a prize. Nominally for effort and achievement, probably in fact for having a dad with cancer. But no matter. All winners were allowed to choose any book they wanted as long as that book was under £2. And one Friday lunch hour, they bundled the 20 of us down to the children's section of Catford Shopping Centre's W.H. Smith's, where we were allotted 10 minutes to make our choices. I scanned the shelves. There was not much there, and what little there was, I, fortunate indulged child that I was, already had. I was about to settle for a treasury of something or other. The completest in me already hated treasuries with a passion that has not abated over the years. Give me a whole book or give me nothing. Either's fine. Don't give me extracts. Don't tease me. When I saw them. The Macmillan William Brown books. White spines, red lettering, a full set of Richmal Crompton's finest, taking up at least half a yard of upper shelf. My prize money allowed the purchase of two. Did they have the ones I needed to complete my collection? William and Air Raid Precautions and William and the Evacuees? They did. I floated out of the shop on air. To my surprise, my parents shook their heads in disappointment at my choice. I should have gone for a hardback, something more classic and uplifting than William Brown, apparently, as a prize. This notion of book as object rather than mass of content was new to me. I considered it with interest and rejected it entirely. There was, I reasoned, a finite amount of cash and number of opportunities for acquisition in this world, and neither should be wasted on getting a book that was beautiful but that you didn't want to read. Quantity of content over quality of livery has been the philosophy I've clung to ever since, which is why, when I die, second-hand book dealers, in the unlikely event they've survived that long, will not be looking over my accumulated library with a covetous eye, but advising my surviving relatives on how many skips to hire. I was once interviewed by a man from a book-collecting magazine because he refused to believe that I had 10,000 books in my house that were all merely, in the parlance of the trade, reading copies. He came, he saw, he left. He wrote that it looked like I had a jumble sale hoisted on my walls. I was hurt on my book's behalf, but I couldn't argue. Back home, things were better in the sense that my dad wasn't ill, just convalescing, but worse in the sense that, having failed to get better in the time decreed reasonable by his boss, he had lost his job. And things were the same, in that my parents, as the non-pariahs of rainy day savers, this didn't plunge us into penury, although as time wore on we did start taking in foreign students from the TFL place down the road as lodgers. Which was fine. They used all the hot water and I had a lot of cold showers, but generally they stayed out of my way and I stayed out of theirs. One of them once tried to help me with my Spanish homework, but she was Brazilian, and it turned out they spoke an entirely different kind of Spanish from school Spanish, so we went back to just nodding and smiling as we passed each other on the landing after another hot-slash-freezing shower. It would make more sense if at this point I developed a taste for fantasy, but I went the other way instead and discovered Bernard Ashley's 1974 novel, The Trouble with Donovan Croft. Donovan Croft is what was then called the product of a broken home. His mother has had to return to Jamaica, and his father cannot work sufficient hours at his low-paid job and still look after his son, so he's put into foster care. His trouble, by the time he arrives to be looked after by 13-year-old Keith's family, is that he doesn't speak. That, at least, is the trouble with Donovan Croft for everyone else. A number of them also consider the fact that he's black to be equally bothersome. But for everyone who has his welfare at heart, his despairing father, his stymied foster family, his frustrated head teacher and social workers, it is the retreat into silence that matters. Bernard Ashley's story was part of a movement that started in the 1970s towards providing children with stories about modern protagonists facing contemporary difficulties, or old difficulties with a contemporary spin. A lot of these so-called problem novels dealt with single issues, divorce, bullying, sexism, racism, in fairly basic one-note ways. Perhaps aided by his years of experience as a teacher, his first stories were written for children in his special needs class. They were seen by an educational publisher visiting his school and published in 1966. Croft was his first novel. As well as his natural talent, Ashley's wasn't one of them. His book is the story of what happens when the normal patterns of life are disrupted, about the effects of insecurity and unhappiness on children, particularly, and on those around them, compounded in Croft's case by racism. All this is woven in and out of a pitch-perfect evocation of the wordlessly growing friendship between Donovan and the Chapman's son, Keith. Despite Keith's own frustration with his mute foster brother and his own ostracism that follows from his association with the weird new kid in the playground, and of Donovan's profound sense of being an afterthought in a grown-up world, familiar to all children, though usually to a lesser extent. I remember the strange feeling of having privileged access to his inner monologues and the urge which grew to almost unbearable proportions as the book continued to refuse to yield easy answers to a boy's despair, for him to speak, to Keith, to his father, to anyone about a misery lying too deep for either tears or words. It was further proof, to add to end of terms, that people contained multitudes. But more than that, the trouble with Donovan Croft made it clear that people's perceptions of each other were rarely pure and never simple. When Donovan's authoritarian form teacher reacts with violent hostility to what he, aided by a degree of racism, perceives as his new pupil's dumb insolence, it started to become clear to me for the first conscious time that we might all be looking at each other through the distorting prisms of our own limited understanding and various prejudices. This was both interesting and infuriating. Life, it seemed, could turn out to be a lot more complex and frankly exhausting than I had originally thought. I then went on a little 1970s gritty realism spree. I polished off a few more Ashleys, including Break in the Sun and Running Scared. Break in the Sun, which was on television at the time, though I refused to watch it, as I refused to watch all book adaptations on the grounds that nobody should be encouraged to mess with perfection, almost broke me. That a child could be driven to running away from home for real, by in this case a violent stepfather, rather than Catherine Storr's Lucy style, seemed to me about the most awful thing imaginable. Running Scared, a novelisation of the 1986 TV drama he wrote for the BBC, which didn't suffer the drop in quality most novelisations do, and was shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal, was less harrowing. I writhed in delicious agony throughout this tense thriller that posed endless questions about divided loyalties and matters of conscience that, rereading now, I find the intervening 30 years have done nothing to simplify. Then came Sylvia Sherry's A Pair of Jesus Boots, and its sequel, A Pair of Desert Wellies, whose anti-hero, Rocky O'Rourke, growing up in a poor part of Liverpool, gradually comes to realise that the wayward big brother he idolises is not as worthy of his adoration as he thought, and that he must choose whether to follow the family's or his own path. Sally and I both read Catherine Patterson's Bridge to Terabithia, a beautifully written story of a friendship that grows between two school outsiders, Jessie and Leslie, who establish their own private kingdom, Terabithia, by a stream in the woods. While Jessie is away, Leslie goes there alone and falls and drowns. Sally was shattered. I was not. Upon questioning, it turned out that I had not understood what had happened. The denial Jessie moves into had confused me. I didn't understand what he was doing and thought, therefore, that everyone else must have got it wrong and that Leslie was indeed, as Jessie insisted, still alive. Sally, both a better reader and more emotionally literate than I was, instructed me to reread the end, and this time, with Patterson pulling me gently on and Sally pushing valiantly from behind, I got it. I was shattered in my turn and Sally was satisfied. I began to see how maybe, just occasionally, books and people could work in harmony. Maybe it wasn't always necessary to reject the one in order to embrace the other. It would be many years before I acted on this thought, but still, I was glad to have it. The library yielded Cynthia Voigt's Dicey's Song, and I slogged through it. It was the first time I ever found myself unable to suspend my disbelief. The idea of four children abandoned by their mentally ill mother in a Connecticut car park making it all the way to their aunt's and then grandmother's house, umpty billion miles away, without getting kidnapped, killed, or at least picked up by the police and sent straight to the foster homes they're desperate to avoid, seemed to me, in such an otherwise acutely realistic book, impossible. Somehow, though you would think my incredulity would have inoculated against it, it was nevertheless harrowing. They reach their destination, and are eventually taken in by their grandmother, but their mother remains in a catatonic state in a Boston hospital. It seemed to me that without your mother, in a functional state, there could not, should not even be an attempt at a happy ending. With the great continent slowly flooding, how would you be able to do anything but try and beat back the rising tides of anxiety, fear, and misery? No, Cynthia, your American optimism was not for me. It was all deeply unsettling. I took a brief break in the light-hearted world of hanging out with Cece about a rebellious teen who travels back in time and ends up becoming friends with her own now also teenage mother by Francine Pascal, whose Sweet Valley High series I was, oh, happy California summer's day, very soon to meet. Then I returned, slightly gingerly, to the fray with some Betsy Byers from the paperback carousels in Torridon and the school libraries. The Pinballs, the Civil War, the 18th Emergency, the Cartoonist, the last was my particular favourite, though less for its likely but beautifully and accurately sketched depiction of the family dysfunction caused by an immature mother and her preference for one son over the rest of her children, than for the protagonist Alfie's attic. A room of your own, soon under threat from the return of the prodigal son, Bubba, who their fond mamma insists needs the attic to live in, was my dream, and I lusted over Alfie's as I had Joe March's a few years before. Alfie drew cartoons and pinned them up all around him. I planned to write and keep everything hidden, but other than that, we were soulmates. I have a room of my own now, incidentally, and it is every bit as good as I thought it would be. SVH. Hey, do you know what? I'm getting a bit of a rush of blood to the head and wanting to go crazy for a moment. Let's take our own break from these tales of misery, maternal favouritism, and child roadside abandonment, and turn our faces to the bright, glorious, gloriously stupid sunshine of Sweet Valley High right now. I don't know what's happening. The wild, carefree spirit of Jessica Wakefield seems to be moving through me, but let's do it. This was the first book craze ever to hit school. Suddenly, everyone was reading. Pink, yellow, and lilac paperbacks blossomed like flowers across the playground. Everyone loved them. I loved them. It was a heady time. Nobody could get enough of them. Especially me, as I wasn't allowed to buy them. Well, that's not quite true. My parents never forbade me to buy any book, but they made their feelings known. And somehow, when my mother made her feelings known, I never really felt like butting up against them, any more than I've ever felt like butting up against an electric fence or bundle of razor wire. Also, they were, compared to other books, fantastically expensive. £1.75 a throw in 1986 was serious money. I presume now that this was a result of the fact that the books were not books in the traditional sense, written by a writer and published by a normal firm in the normal manner, but part of a sprawling industry creating merchandise rather than art. Brighter sparks in the playground might have realised that producing a dozen books a year was beyond the scope of even the most prolific author, but I did not. Astute observers might have noticed that the covers read, "Created by," rather than "Written by," Francine Pascal, but I did not. It was only in recent years that I realised they were composed by conglomerate. I always like to imagine Pascal sometime in the early 1980s suddenly sitting bolt upright in the middle of the night in a satin-sheeted bed and crying, "Twins! The same! Yet so different! And Lavaliers!" before falling fast back to sleep again, the better to birth her creation refreshed in the morning. I'm delighted to tell you now that that is basically what happened. Pascal had previously worked with her husband as a TV writer. In 1982, in the middle of a sticky patch while writing her latest book for teenagers, Love and Betrayal and Hold the Mayo, she remembered an idea she had had for a soap opera about teenagers. An editor friend of hers suggested that it might be better as a series of books. Possibly this was an artistic consideration, but equally possibly it was a commercial one, to capitalise on the fact that by now, teenagers controlled a decent amount of money of their own and were buying books for themselves rather than relying on parents and librarians to choose and hand them down from on high. Either way, Pascal went to her typewriter and banged out this. "They are the most perfect twins in the world, Elizabeth and Jessica Wakefield. One is good, one is bad. Cliffhanger endings, continuing characters. The action is always carried by the kids. They run their world, which is very appealing." Yes, Francine. Yes. She is named as author of the first two of what would become 143-strong core series, plus innumerable spin-offs. The rest were entirely produced by a host of freelance ghostwriters. Their job was to create, as far as possible, uniform products for a company dedicated to the Pascal Wakefield Enterprise 17th Street Productions. They used a Bible, notes on themes, characters, settings and so on, compiled by Pascal to ensure consistency, and worked to outline she provided. They were a band of typing postgrad monkeys stretching from sea to shining sea, producing for a fixed fee 140 pages every 6 to 8 weeks. They blended blue jeans, good-hearted hunks, glowering bad boys, motorcycle accidents, Fiat spiders, Southern Californian ocean views, split-level housing, Spanish-tiled kitchens, rich bitches, occasional comas, and bouts of hysterical paralysis in perfect proportions. For which sterling efforts I, and judging by the response my Twitter feed gets whenever I mention your output, the rest of my generation, remain eternally grateful. I hunted down what scraps I could of this perfect escapist fluff. Torridon only stocked a few of the 12 million copies that were in print by 1986, while the school library eschewed them entirely. And their idealized world and formulaic nature was a joy. They were the Enid Blytons of early teendom, except that, as long as I shut down critical faculties for the duration and ignore the preponderance of rapey boyfriends, yes, Bruce Patman, I'm looking at you, I can still read them now with delight. You could settle down with Taking Sides, Perfect Shot, or Wrong Kind of Girl, and know that you were in safe hands. Elizabeth and Jessica would always be blonde, size 6 twins, with sparkling blue-green eyes and those golden lavaliers. What were they? No idea. So glamorous. Round their necks and feeding each side of your warring adolescent psyche in turn. Elizabeth was ego, sensible, responsible, good at English and impulse control. Jessica was untrammeled id, a slender sociopath you couldn't help but love. Unless you were Todd, who hated her. Until he didn't. But let us not dwell on sororal treachery now. The lean SVH years came to a sudden end with the most remarkable stroke of good luck. Sally went to a local jumble sale one Saturday and found, just lying there on the bookstall as if they were ordinary paperbacks instead of manna from the Teen Romance Committee gods, a 20-strong run of SVHs. She gathered them in trembling arms and in a quavering voice asked how much they were. 10 pence each, came the unbelievable reply. Sally, whose mouth usually got her into more trouble than it ever talked her out of, had the sense this once to keep shtum. She piled them into a box, handed over her dues, and got the hell out of Dodge. Her face still lights up at the memory now. For barely more than the price of one new volume, we gorged for days on the adventures of SoCal's finest. Jessica pretended to be Elizabeth for bad reasons. Elizabeth pretended to be Jessica for good reasons. Todd did various Toddish things, Toddishly. Enid arrived. She was the one who got the hysterical paralysis B-plot, like Fallon in Dynasty, which I was, not coincidentally, consuming with almost as much avidity at the time. Jessica crushed people's dreams, manipulated her family as naturally as she breathed, stole innumerable boyfriends from innumerable lesser, nicer females, drove the vulnerable to attempt suicide, and everyone continued to find her rising sociopathy vaguely charming. Just as they did with Alexis Carrington. And Elizabeth is crystal. Cultural synergy. People pretended to be rich, other people pretended to be poor. Bit Partis died of leukemia and of trying drugs once. Just so you know, kids. Elizabeth, after discovering that even getting kidnapped by a hospital orderly, just say no to candy striping too, kids, doesn't make her interesting, rebelled against her good girl image and, went surfing. Stephen came and went from college, tripping a few plot switches along the way. Unhappy rich girls shoplifted, chubby people lost weight, and I dare say a few ghostwriters lost their minds. The New York Times must certainly have had to pop a restorative pill or two when Perfect Summer became the first young adult novel ever to make its paperback bestseller list, as it did in 1985, alongside books by Norman Mailer, Leon Uris, and John Updike. No matter. We loved it all. Yes, we were being indoctrinated with constricting and toxic messages about sexuality, femininity, wealth, and assorted other aspects of humanity and society that you would prefer people kept as free and open a mind about as possible. But on the other hand, Robin got slim and won the school-sponsored beauty pageant. School-sponsored beauty pageant. What the actual was going on in 1980s SoCal. And got made a Phi Beta bum crack and became co-head of the cheerleading squad, guys. It was awesome. Bloom. Sally and I found much else in Bibliocommon. We were moving into the lighter end of adult fare, for some reason via the biographies of the more or less picturesquely poverty-stricken. Christine Marion Fraser's Blue Above the Chimneys and Helen Forrester's Tuppence to Cross the Mersey figured large. But our greatest bond was Anne Digby's Trebizond. This was another boarding school series, but, get this, set in the modern world. It was disconcerting. All the standard fixtures and fittings were there. A new girl, Rebecca Mason, who, after temporarily falling for the blandishments of what was not, even in that modern setting, quite known as a bitch, realises the error of her ways and becomes firm friends with an established gang of school stalwarts, with one defined